This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many of us awoke on Saturday to the news that John Kennedy Jr.'s plane had disappeared en route to Martha's Vineyard. For those of us who wanted to find out what happened, there was no shortage of coverage. For about 12 hours, several broadcast and cable networks preempted their regular programming for continuous coverage of the search. But they had little new information to report. It could make you wonder, were the networks not just reporting on, but also exploiting this unfolding tragedy? Media critic Tom Rosensteel says the Kennedy coverage fits into a larger phenomenon he describes as the blockbuster mentality. Rosensteel is the director of Harvard University's Project for Excellence in Journalism and vice chair of the Committee of Concerned Journalists. He's former media critic for the LA Times and co-author of the new book, Warp Speed, America in the Age of Mixed Media. We called him this morning and asked how he learned about the disappearance.
Well, like a lot of people, I was turning on the media for some other reason and bumped into this. In this case, I was going to check out a golf tournament on ABC television, the British Open, and saw that it was being preempted by a special report, and there's this moment of searching, what is it, what happened, and very quickly came to realize that JFK Jr.'s plane was missing. It had been missing for about 12 hours, and they didn't know much.
Now, I want to ask you first what your reaction was to hearing about the plane crash, or what was presumed to have been a plane crash at the time.
Well, my first reaction was, oh, gee, it's another tragedy for the Kennedy family. And then my second reaction, almost a moment later, was, gee, this is an awful lot of coverage. They're preempting this, and I flipped channels and saw the scope of the press attention and realized that everybody was preempting everything and assumed that this would go on for 10 or 15 minutes because it was pretty obvious that they didn't know very much, and was surprised momentarily, and then there was a sort of familiar ring to it when I realized, oh no, they're going to stay on this for a long time. This is going to be hours with this.
Why do you think there was such extensive coverage of so little in the way of new facts?
Well, there are two reasons, really. The first is we've entered a phenomenon now in what I call the age of the mixed media culture, of the blockbuster story, the big story phenomenon. It's not unlike Hollywood and the fascination with the summer blockbuster hit movie. The problem is that today the mass media audience for news has fragmented. The best research suggests that no one segment of the news audience is bigger than about 20%. And these stories, these big, big sensationalized stories that involve celebrity, tragedy, usually some aura of sex, sensationalism, the classic sort of tabloid elements, are in a sense crossover stories that temporarily reassemble that mass audience for news. They appeal to the audience that likes politics. They appeal to the audience that likes celebrity stories. They appeal to the audience that likes crime stories. They appeal to everyone. And they are like a breakout hit that makes it on the R&B chart and the pop chart and the hip-hop chart. They are a crossover story. And so they are a way, at a time when the networks are hemorrhaging audience, losing audience hand over fist, for them to regain, at least momentarily, some ratings. We have seen a phenomenon over the last 5 or 6 years where the networks and the press culture in general gravitates to these stories, whether it's Tonya Harding or OJ or Lady Di or Lewinsky. Internal culture of the press coincides with the commercial desperation to try and find a big story. And in the valleys between these stories, the press actually tries to manufacture them. JonBenet Ramsey was an example of a story that a few years ago would have had very little attention paid to it based on its intrinsic significance. that the press really played up because it had a lot of these elements. As it turned out, JonBenet was a story that really didn't rise to the level of one of these blockbusters, and so it sort of hung around in the supermarket tabloids. But it's a very artificial kind of demand of the news demand of the news organizations trying to create a demand among the consumers.
Do you have a sense of who makes the call at TV broadcast and cable networks about when it's time to preempt regular programming for special live coverage? Is it someone in an editorial position? Is it someone above them in a higher management position?
Well, it's usually someone. The first call is made from somebody at the news desk who says, "We've got such and such a situation." They usually contact the highest person in the news division, which may be the president of the news division or somebody just below him, and that person then goes to someone at the network who's above the news division and says, "We want to preempt." The request usually comes from the news division. I don't know precisely what occurred in this case, but it is easier to make this decision on a Saturday morning when you are preempting programming that is not generally generating huge audiences. I mean, a golf tournament or Saturday cartoons are productive, you know, are lucrative, but they don't generate huge audiences, not the kind of audiences that you can get for a national news crisis. And you can always show that those kids' cartoons the week after, and in this case, you could preempt the golf tournament and put it on your cable sports channel, ESPN. So this is an easier call to make on a Saturday morning, or in the case of Diana, on a Saturday night, than it might be on, say, a Sunday night when you've got your highly rated movie of the week or something like that. These calls are also symbiotic. Whether or not something gets preempted is determined jointly, and it's always partly an economic call.
There are certain similarities between John Kennedy's accident and Princess Diana's accident. What were the media lessons from the TV coverage of the Princess Diana car crash?
Well, one is that one is sort of internal to the culture of journalism. One of them was that those networks that didn't go whole hog and stay on the air suffered a kind of critical embarrassment. CBS turned away, was very late on a Saturday night, and they went off the air while NBC and ABC stuck with it, and CNN, obviously. The next day, there was a lot of criticism of TV news that CBS was late with the story, did not have its people in place, and heads rolled inside CBS. People were punished, and some people lost their jobs because of their missing that story. There is also a sense that during a big story like this, that viewers may switch allegiances, that they may say, "Gee, I lived through that the tragedy of JFK with Peter. I think I'm going to watch Peter now for a while, Peter Jennings. I've been watching Dan for the last year, but, you know, I really, we sort of shared that experience together, Peter and I, and now I'm going to go with him for a while." So it's a moment when viewers may switch loyalties, and so it's a moment of opportunity. That's a tradition that's longstanding in the culture of TV news. But there is also a simpler commercial imperative, and that is that particularly for the cable networks, which have, in fact, rather small audiences. CNN, the biggest of them, has about a one rating point most of the time. During moments of these big stories, however brief they may be, they can see their ratings increase rather dramatically, 30, 50%. So there's money to be made in these stories. And when that happens, then the commercial networks, the broadcast networks with bigger audiences say, we have to protect ourselves, particularly CBS and ABC, which don't have a cable outlet. So they say, we'll become a cable outlet ourselves that, during that time, and make sure that we don't lose some of those viewers to the new cable universe.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Rosensteel, and he's a press critic who is the director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism and vice chair of the Committee of Concerned Journalists. He's co-author of the new book, Warp Speed, America in the Age of Mixed Media. Let's take a break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Rosensteel. He's co-author of the new book, Warp Speed, America in the Age of Mixed Media. He's a press critic and director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism and vice chair of the Committee of Concerned Journalists. Tell me if you felt anything similar to this. I found myself feeling very uncomfortable with my own feelings on Saturday. On the one hand, I felt very sorry about what it seemed had happened to John Kennedy. I mean, we really didn't know for sure what had happened, but it seemed likely that the plane had crashed and likely that he and his wife and sister-in-law had not survived. And that's terrible. I mean, that's tragic, very disturbing. At the same time, I felt myself getting very cynical watching the endless TV coverage. And I mean, I didn't watch it straight through, but every time I would turn on the TV, it was still there, and there were, I mean, the only new facts report was maybe there was a piece of luggage with a name tag, but I saw that same piece of luggage and that same name tag listed as breaking news for hours, you know? So, on the one hand, I was feeling very cynical, and the other hand, very sorry, and I didn't want my cynicism to interfere with my, you know, genuine feelings of regret for what had happened to the people on the plane.
Right.
But I didn't want my feelings of regret for the people on the plane to interfere with my genuine skepticism of the media coverage.
I think there are two things going on here. One is that in this era of continuous news, we have an ironic situation. We have more news, but it's less complete. We're getting not news as an end product, but we're getting the raw elements, the grist of news, and we're expected to somehow, I think it's unintentional, edit it for ourselves. It's ironic because it's actually less nourishing. It's sort of a waste of time. You could, if you watched all of this, you'd say, well, that was about a 2 or 3 minutes worth of information that I absorbed over the course of 3 hours. Ironically, there's less time for the journalists involved who are trying to produce this thing every second to sit back and say, wait a second, what do we know here that's true? What's significant? What's not? And you see the difference if you watched some during that first day on Saturday during the day, and then if you tuned back in during the primetime specials, where a different crew of people, take the case of ABC, they had Ted Koppel do a long piece about the Kennedy legacy, and they had a group of historians and journalists who'd cover the Kennedys talking. That was a synthesized end product of journalism, which in the course of an hour really gave you a rather deep understanding, particularly for a television newscast, of what you needed to know. And if you'd simply watched that 1 hour, you probably would have gotten more than if you had watched the endless hours, the 11 hours preceding.
Your book, Warp Speed, uses the Clinton Lewinsky story as the case study for analyzing the state of reporting, particularly in television. And I'm wondering if there are things that we have not yet addressed that came up in your analysis of the Clinton Lewinsky story that show the state of television news.
Well, one of the things, in addition to this blockbuster mentality and the kind of the curse of the continuing news cycle, is that you also have the journalists themselves being in a weakened position vis-a-vis their sources, because there are so many news outlets out there chasing a relatively static number of sources that the sources have the luxury of what you might call a seller's market. A supply and demand phenomenon that helps those who would use the news media and weakens the leverage of the journalists to say, no, I'm not going to go with that. increasingly sources can dictate the terms of the interactions, set the conditions of their own anonymity. It's why we saw more use of single anonymous sourcing and things like that in Lewinsky's story. We also see, because, again, of so much time to fill and so little time for the journalists to report, the rise of what we call the argument culture overwhelming the reporting culture, particularly in the cable universe. It's much cheaper to produce talk shows than to produce news shows. And so this also reinforces the notion of the kind of the blockbuster story, because if you're going to have eight talk shows fill up your day, you need a story that is familiar, that does not require a lot of expertise, and that a casual observer might tune into and watch for 30 minutes, as opposed to a news show, which requires an expensive reporting infrastructure to cover the whole world, and then expects people to watch for just a little while, and then move on with their day.
What impact do you think the changing TV news environment is having on the network evening news programs?
Well, increasingly, they are becoming less important in the culture of the television news business. NBC is the network that is the most successful financially, and the reason is because they have Dateline, which is an infotainment program that does not cover traditional news topics. It covers celebrity and health and consumer news and sort of soap opera stories and some exposés. It's on every night, and it's quite lucrative. Plus, NBC is able to amortize all of its programming by rebroadcasting it and by using its people on MSNBC, its cable outlet. And MSNBC actually rents any programming it gets from NBC News and pays NBC News a fee. So the bottom line is supplemented by all the interlocking parts. The Today Show is another infotainment program that's extremely profitable for NBC. All of that means that what was once the sort of the heart and marquee of the network news divisions, the nightly news, is less important from a purely mathematical standpoint. But there's a subtle effect of that, and that means that increasingly the people who work at NBC never worked in that hard news environment. They were hired to go to Dateline, to go to Today. They never, in a sense, were trained on the city desk in the classical way. They were trained in a feature news environment and may have never covered foreign policy or politics or national security or economics or any of the things that we have traditionally for the last 200 years considered sort of the main grist of the news. And that same phenomenon is happening at all three of the networks. This year, ABC News reduced its correspondent staff by 10%. And the people that it reduced were invariably hard news correspondents being replaced by feature correspondents. It also puts a far greater emphasis on the celebrity anchor, people who are famous and have a Q rating and are popular with audiences, who can become the key personality of the news, television news culture. So you get rid of your Tim O'Brien, the Supreme Court correspondent for ABC, but you renegotiate the contract of George Stephanopoulos and recast him more as a journalist who can report the news and do feature pieces for 2020.
Well, Tom Rosenstiel, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.
Tom Rosenstiel is the director of Harvard University's Project for Excellence in Journalism and co-author of the new book Warp Speed: America in the Age of Mixed Media. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.